be in verse 40 in a few minutes. Our series is this: Messages from the Movies. We're using contemporary movies and a theme from a contemporary movie each week to then look at that theme in Scripture to see what God has to say about that theme. Not about the movie, but about the theme, okay? We've said before that whenever you watch a TV show, a movie, some reel, whatever it may be on the internet, whoever made that is trying to sell you something. And they don't have to sell it to you by money. They sell it to you by influence. Have you noticed that there's a lot of things? Maybe you haven't. There's a lot of things on the internet that are not true. I know. There's a lot of things in movies that you see that are not true. They're trying to sell you some belief system, some value. They're trying to influence you. And if we only watch TV, movies, reels, etc., with the idea to be entertained, it's like opening up your little brain and allowing them to pour into it whatever they want. We have to be discerning in whatever it is that we want. They all want to educate you. They want to stimulate you emotionally. They want to motivate you to do something as a result of what you're seeing. So as they do this, as they work almost subliminally through what their message is, they want to challenge your thinking and influence your thinking, your feelings, and how you act. Are you with me? So even when we watch clips here in church sometimes, or we learn about movies, or I refer to a TV show, always use your brain about what it is that we're talking, so that we're not just naive and taken captive, as the Bible says, have our thoughts taken captive by the enemy. Now, sometimes movies, they're singular movies. One movie, one and done, I call it. Other times, they take a movie and it has a theme, and they'll put two or three movies together. It's called a series or a sequel or a movie franchise. All those terms have been used. Now, movie series are a lot like picking out a watermelon, if you will, at Meijer. You realize there is an art to picking out a proper watermelon or a cantaloupe or whatever. There's an art form. How do you do it? You go to Google and trust that they're telling you the right thing. So there are watermelons at Meijer that you bring home, you taste it, and it makes your eyes flutter. It's that good. There's other watermelons you eat, and there's a little bit of a taste to it. It's not like you want a gag. It's like, okay, I'll eat this because I paid for it. Then there are watermelons, cantaloupes, etc., that you eat, and you go, it's just terrible, and you set the whole thing aside. There are movie series like that. Have you figured that one out? There are some that start off great. They start off with a wonderful first movie, and then the rest are all terrible. Think about movie series, because that's what we're going to talk about for a moment around your table. If you have ever watched a series, it could be a series on TV, okay? Series of shows. Friends, Seinfeld, MASH, those are all older ones, considered some of the best TV series there's ever been. But are there not movies that are in a series? So we're talking specifically about movies at your table. If you had to pick a series, now you may say, I don't go to the movies, I don't watch movies, I'm Amish, whatever it may be, what would your favorite series be? And you can listen to others, and somebody's going to say something, and you're just going to roll your eyes and go, that's the dumbest thing I ever saw, right? Others are going, oh, I love that one. Okay, we don't want to give a reader's, we want a Reader's Digest version. I like this series because of this person or this action. Don't sit there and like go through all your copious notes of what's so good about the series. You with me? So refrain from arguments. We are the church. All right, what's your favorite series? And I'll tell you mine right now. Is it the absolute number one series of my entire life? I've watched a few movies and series in my short existence. It is in the top two or three, and it's The Lord of the Rings. I like that. You look at me, what's that? I never heard of it before. Okay, that's my favorite series. Why? Because I love the mystique of the characters and how they're developed. I've read the books that they're based on. I just love the way Peter Jackson put the films together. That's what I would say. What are you going to say? You got about 4 or 5 minutes. Go. All right, let's kind of bring it in. Now, there's too many movie series to have many of you report on them. So, like I mentioned, The Lord of the Rings, known as the trilogy, thanks, Gary, for being with me on that one, was directed by Peter Jackson. It's one of the great film series that has ever been produced. Evie and I went to New Zealand a number of years ago. In part, I have a good friend and his wife that are there. They're from the Detroit area. They've moved there to do ministry. But we also went there because at that time we were both hooked on Lord of the Rings. I had read the books. I wanted to see the sets in which the movie had been filmed. It was an incredible experience. But you say, I don't know anything about it. Well, I just happen to have a book I can recommend to you. Middle Earth is the fantasy world in which this movie takes place, by the author, his name is J.R.R. Tolkien. Now, if you don't know this, Tolkien was a devout Catholic and a believer in Jesus Christ. He and another man who you may have heard of called C.S. Lewis. Have you ever heard that name? Famous author. They were contemporaries. They oftentimes met together, smoked pipes together, and in England, and they talked about their writings. They both lived in a fantasy world. They both were incredibly intelligent people and could speak multiple languages. And for this series of books, The Lord of the Rings, that took place in this mythical land called Middle Earth, this is how smart Tolkien was. He created his own language. And if you read the books, you're going, I don't understand that word. Well, you wouldn't. It's all in his head. So it's a three-movie series. People had thought for decades this should be done in a film, but it was never done in a film because no director felt he could ever pull it off, create the environment of a Middle Earth until we got it into what we would call modern technology. So we're looking at this, this series, Lord of the Rings, and we're actually going to focus on the first book. I'm just going to draw some truths from the first book, called The Fellowship of the Ring. Now, again, if you don't know anything about what I'm talking about here, join my wife. She oftentimes doesn't know what I'm talking about. But this series, I really think, for every Christian family, C.S. Lewis's writings and also Tolkien's writings here, or the film, should be watched if you have children growing up. It doesn't just entertain them. Because throughout both authors' series of books, they use Christian themes, biblical themes throughout all the writings, and they're carried over into the films. So as parents and grandparents, it would if you really want to help your kids grasp deeper truths about the Bible and to understand God and understand Jesus and understand especially how the church should work, I would highly recommend Lord of the Rings. So a dummy's book is good. I've got several books similar to this that I have read over the years to try to help me to understand the series. So the movies chronicle, if you will, a quest. Now, we just got done with Paul's Odyssey. This is a quest where they have a task that has to be performed. It's a quest to save Middle Earth from the Dark Lord. A Lord who rules all of Middle Earth called Sauron in the writings. He is the parallel to somebody we know as Christians as a dark lord who oversees planet Earth. What's his name? Satan or devil or Lucifer, known as the accuser, known as a liar, known as a murderer in Scripture. If you read, you don't have to be super bright to understand this. The books are about good and evil and the battle between the two of them. So it deals with what we would call the timeless battle. All of humanity, even just our own history, it's good versus evil. Every element of history, any generation you want to go to in human history, there's always good, there's always evil, and sometimes the evil wins. We pray that the good will win more than what the evil does. Doesn't mean God created evil. Evil exists simply because good does. God created everything, and it was called in the book of Genesis chapter 1, what? Good. And Satan perverts all of it. This book, this series, deals with the friends, and another word, play on words, are the fiends involved in the writings, just as the Bible also contains a lot of stories of good people and people who are horrible. It deals with the trials, but also the triumphs of all the characters engaged in the series. But is that not our Bible? Doesn't our Bible talk about the successes and the failures, the wins and the losses of the Bible characters? Yes or no? Yes, it does. It contrasts those who walk in the light, those who walk in the dark. And Jesus was very plain about that. He has come. He's brought light to humanity, goodness, serenity, peace, forgiveness, a right relationship with God, and the devil's clinging to darkness. And Jesus very much talks about the battle of light versus darkness. But Tolkien himself said this in writing about his writings. He said, the real story, the main theme, in my writings, these three books deals with the reality of death and immortality. It's throughout his writings. And see, we're so caught up in characters, we're caught up in maps, we're caught up in the battles and all, what's an elf like, that sometimes we miss what the author is trying to tell us. So he writes about death, because we see characters die, even some of the good people die. But he also talks about the fact that you may die on this earth, but you what? Live what? Somewhere else for eternity. So that's a good reason, if no other reason, for you and I as Christians with children, grandchildren, etc., to make sure that our kids are exposed to healthy writings that convey biblical truth in a way that especially children can understand. He didn't write this just for mature adults. He wrote it so that kids and teenagers and young adults could understand scriptural truth, but understand it creatively. So the central plot of The Lord of the Rings is a quest to destroy a ring, a powerful ring that controls all other rings. You say, what is this about? You'd have to read the books or buy the book. The one about dummies, all right, to understand all of that. But the central quest is this ring has to be destroyed because if Sauron gets a hold of the ring, he controls all of humanity. The world truly becomes his. So Sauron is an evil creature. If you think of all the villains in the TV shows and the movies we've watched, there's been some good ones. Gary's favorite Christmas movie is? Die Hard, okay. Had a great villain in there, correct? We're used to villain. Sauron is on screen one of the worst villains that there's ever been created, if you will. And remember, Sauron is simply the way that Tolkien imagined Satan to be. You and I think Satan runs around in a little red suit, little horns, and a pitchfork. No, he's far worse than that. The Bible calls him a liar, calls him a murderer, calls him a deceiver. He wants to destroy every life on planet Earth, especially the church. So how does he do it? Biblical history, Old New Testament. He comes after leadership. both in God's family, Israel, also in the church, but also in the family. God will take, or not God, I'm sorry, the God of this earth, Satan wants to take down husbands and wants to take down wives. He wants to drive a wedge between them if possible, and if possible, take any one of them and destroy them, because he knows that takes down the children and the grandkids. So all of this is taught throughout these books, Lord of the Rings. The whole storyline follows Sauron's plan, if you will, to regain the ring, because somebody has the ring. It's been passed down to him. His name is Frodo. Frodo is a hobbit, okay? What do we know about hobbits? They're small. They're very fun to be around. They're peace-loving people. And they have hairy what? Big, hairy feet. Okay, that's about a third of the guys in here, all right? Except you're a little taller than maybe what a hobbit would be. Frodo Baggins has the ring, and they understand that if we're going to stop Sauron, the ring has to be destroyed. Sauron wants the ring. Can you see potential for problems here? It's a wonderful storyline between these three books, and there's a book prior to this called The Hobbit, and a book that follows it called The Silmarillion. We're only looking at the series, and particularly the first book of the series. Fellowship of the Ring. The ring's all important. The ring. Not many rings. The ring. There's one ring that has to be destroyed. So they know to fight Sauron, to defeat Sauron, the ring has to be destroyed. So if you read the story, again, this may mean nothing to you if you've never seen it, if you've never read it, but the representatives of the free people of Middle Earth come together. It'd be like a good United Nations, if such a thing could ever exist. Okay, the free people, the people who are not a slave to Sauron, come together and they're debating, what do we do about all of this? They're trying to figure out a plan. Well, they know the ring has to be destroyed, and the ring has to be destroyed where, Gary? In Mount Doom, where it was created, all right? Has to go back into the fire. So it's a wonderful story when you read this. I'm on the seat of, all right, sorry, on the edge of my seat, not on the seat of my edge, although it could be, I'm not sure. Somebody volunteers to destroy the ring, and it's the holder of the ring. It's Frodo, what's his last name? Baggins. And then some other people stand up, representatives of the larger group that are there. They say, we'll go with them. We'll help them. We'll protect them. We'll be there to fight the battle with them. But it's Frodo's battle because he's got the ring. Isn't it great when your friends rally around you, family rallies around you? You've got an nearly impossible task. You're facing danger. You're facing trouble. Isn't it great when families or friends say, I'll support you? There's a lot of people who will say, go for it. Do your thing. Yeah, go battle Sauron. We'll just sit here in safety. Do you realize if we don't get involved in our world and fight the evil of our culture, that eventually the darkness of the Dark Lord will take all of us? If we do not stand up and stand up together, whether as a family, as a church, as friends, when we go against the evil of this world, then the evil of the world will win out. So we got to stand together. That's a great lesson here. So four hobbits, little diminutive people with very hairy feet, thank you. There's a wizard, his name is Gandalf. There's an elf. His name is? Legolas. If you say, I don't want to buy that book, then just hang out with Gary. Then there's a dwarf. His name is? Gimli. Thank you. And there's two natural men. We won't talk about who they are. So that's the representatives of the free world. They decide, we're coming together. We'll help Frodo. There's a million things that we could go into. Here's a picture of the nine. There's a reason that it just so happens to be nine. You'd have to read the book, see the movie to know why, because on the other side there's nine. So it all, as you read this, you're going, huh. It's almost like the guy knew. He wasn't just on an acid trip. He actually knew what he was writing about. He's got truths he's trying to communicate. Tolkien himself didn't call them the Fellowship. That's how most of us moviegoers and book readers would refer to them. Tolkien himself said they're called the Company. He called them the company, and there was a reason for that. Companio is a Latin word that that our word company is taken from. Here's the definition of a companio: a person who shares bread, a co-traveler on the road, or a group who have a shared purpose or mission. So if I say this is my company, it's not just people that I sit at a table with. It's people that I'm bonded together with. People where there's a band that holds us together. There's a commonality that is bigger than our own life, our single life. This company of the ring said, if we die doing this, so be it. But we're going to die together. We're going to die, and not just all at the same time, but we're going to die for that cause. That cause is greater than our life. It is worth giving our life to. The companionship, the company, the companio is a perfect picture of the church. That when God created the church and empowered them with the Spirit, He gave them a cause far bigger than any one of their lives. And it was this: to take the gospel message to the world. Because the world is perishing. The world is in danger of the darkness of the dark Lord taking them, sweeping them in eternity, separated from God. And the early church said this: if we die, we die together. But we're going to take the message from here to the world. No one man, no one woman had to do it alone. They bonded, and you might add the word banded, together. The group was there to protect and to provide. They were to help one another. You realize in a church, it's not the pastor's job. It's not an elder's job. It's not a deacon's job. It is our job to take the message of Christ to our world. Just let that sink in. It's our job. And if we have a church where this group of people are highly passionate about Jesus and they want to see their friends and family come to faith, and they'll do anything to see that happen, and then we have this part of the church that doesn't care. This part of the church that just wants to suck up the blessings that they bring from obedience to God into the congregation. How's this church ever going to work together if you got half of the group that sides with Jesus and half the group that just sides with themselves and only wants what they want? How do you accomplish anything spiritual? How do you accomplish anything that's really significant? How do you accomplish anything that's eternal in nature when you have people with that attitude? Would it be difficult? Just put it into your family. Your family's a companion or a company. People committed to a purpose, isn't it? So you got a husband and a wife going in two different directions. One loves God, one doesn't care about God or is apathetic towards God. How's that family going to influence those kids for Jesus? It's going to be a stinking battle. Yes? It will be. And it doesn't matter if it's your business where part of you want to go this way in the business and part of you don't care about going anywhere. You're always going to have battles unless we are united in purpose. Now, if you watch the movie, we've got elves. Elves don't like dwarves. All the people are they don't trust humans, and they have probably good reason not to trust us. Okay? There's conflict. You can have conflict and still agree in one fundamental purpose, and that's we're going to do something together. Husbands and wives, do you have conflict? They're called children, right? Husbands and wives, even in the best of marriages, still have conflict because you have a male and you have a female. Only one of them's right. Right? Just ask either one who's right. So you're always going to have conflict. Conflict doesn't mean you can't accomplish your purpose. Actually, it adds a degree of passion. A conflict allows you to talk and converse and to communicate and to determine what is the best plan to help us get to where we want to go. It allows the two of you to hash things through and come to a common agreement, assuming you're both mature people. And assuming a church has mature what? People. So when you look at this company of the nine, company of the ring, the nine of them, it's a classic study on people learning to work together. If for no other reason, read the book, see the movie, to learn how to deal with conflict in any relationship and still accomplish something that's significant. It's a wonderful book. They have to resolve their conflict. They first of all have to identify the conflict, resolve the conflict. They have to set aside personal agendas for a common agenda. That'll either make or break your marriage. If you each want to have your own way, good luck, it ain't ever going to work. But if you can set aside your personal agendas and your own preferences and say, what's best for us, not just me, it forces you to strategize together. When you look at these nine, they have to sacrifice for a cause that's bigger than life. All of them realize they could die in pursuit of this cause. In the early church, they knew they could die representing Jesus to the world. And you know what? It was worth it. And that's the problem with so many people in the American churches, our American church. All we want is comfort. We want our way. We want an easy street. We're okay with just being religious. But you go outside of this country to the rest of the world, there are Christians dying for their faith. Have any of you read about Nigeria? 100,000 Christians have been slaughtered across that nation. Do you catch that in our media? And you have to ask yourself, why? Slaughtered by who? There's a religious group called Islam that is killing off most of the Christians in Nigeria. They have an agenda. They are willing to die for their faith, Muslims are. They're also willing to kill you for their faith. Do you understand that? And yet so many Christians today are apathetic. We're comfortable. Just give me an easy sermon, make me feel good and laugh so I can go home like the three little pigs and laugh and sing and play all day. But the Christians in the rest of the world are having to put up with persecution, with being tortured and death for most of them in Nigeria to represent Jesus. And when you watch the nine here, they're willing to pay the price. Give me a passionate person who loves Jesus, but not just in word, passionate where they will do something for Jesus with their life. When you study this, when you look at these nine, you laugh at them. People are comical. Have you ever sat there and listened to somebody, maybe your spouse, this is not true of us, because we're totally in harmony. Have you ever listened to somebody, a friend, a family member, and they're given their rationale, and you're like, Sandy, you're interrupting me. Go away, you bother me. That's the stupidest thing I ever heard. And you do this. You're trying to be nice. You're trying to be polite. Hey, that's the nine. They have to deal with us all the time. But you can still disagree. You can still find people exceedingly weird and funny and still move together for the common good. Tolkien wrote all of these characters about these characters in such a way that you and I can say, that's my Uncle Bill. That's the person sitting across the table from me right now. He took people he knew and he wrapped their quirky characteristics into these characters. So when we read this, we go, wow, the biblical part that he's injecting into this storyline, I see it. It makes sense to me. He was an absolute master of helping us to understand the gospel, to understand biblical history, to understand the early church without using those words. If you do more than just watch for entertainment, if you begin to about what is being communicated to you. So Tolkien uses the phrase Company of the Ring. It teaches and illustrates biblical teamwork. The Nine is a perfect example of how to get along with one another. How to get along in your family, how to get along in your church. There's no magical, mystical, perfect marriage or perfect church. As long as you've got dwarves, we've got some dwarves here. As long as you've got elves, as long as you've got humans, and some of you with hairy feet, we've got you as a hobbit. You're going to have conflict, but we can prioritize Jesus and his mission and get along in spite of all of those things. Banding together helps us to accomplish a mission that's bigger than anyone's life. Anyone's life. When you think of the church, when you think of the church and you think of biblical history, do you see groups of people coming together for a cause where they have to sacrifice, they have to serve, they have to step down a notch with their ego in order for that group to work together? Do you see any cases like that? The Bible is full of examples. Any examples come to mind where people work together for a cause bigger than their life? Yes? Who? Don't just say yes because I want to hear it. Who? How about Noah and his family building a boat? 120 years. There wasn't a huge family. The boat is called the Ark. You think they ever had any disagreements? Dads, have you ever tried to teach your sons, maybe your wife, your daughters-in-law, what various tools are used for? Bring me a hammer and you get a saw. And you just kind of, like, that's the 12th time this year you brought me a saw. She hasn't got it yet. He hasn't got it. There was conflict. What other groups had to learn to work together? Who? The disciples. Who else? Who? Moses. Moses, okay, there's only 1.5 million of you. Pick up your stuff here. We've been here for 400 years in Egypt. Okay, we're going to the promised land. And you're all going, what? It's not even, the guy's looking at Google. He's looking at Google Maps going, there's nothing here that says promised land. I know it's not there yet. But pick up your stuff. You're going to follow me. Here we go. 1.5 million people. Do I have your attention? He's got his brother Aaron. He's got his sister Miriam. He's got Caleb. He's got Joshua. That's only like 5 people that are going, yes, we can do it. And the rest are going, do they have a hot now there? You know, they want what they want. They don't even understand what he's talking about. And the leadership team has to work together to cast vision to motivate people from where they are to where God wants them to be. Who else in the Bible? Paul and his team. He had Titus. He had Timothy. He had Silas. There was Barnabas. There were others. You can think, how about David? King David had to get his mighty men together to conquer the Philistines. Throughout the Bible, Old and New Testament, you see teams of people saying, hey, if this is what God wants, we're in this together. The story captures it. It tells us about what the church should be. You're now in Acts chapter 2, verse 40. 4 points this morning to think about, not just from a scriptural standpoint, going, oh, that's nice that it's in the Bible. This is our church, folks. This is your life we're talking about. Number one, in verse 40, it says, the church came out of a dark and evil world. That's the point. Look at verse 40. With many words, he, Peter, remember he's talking to thousands and thousands of people. He's preaching his message. And he pleaded with them. What did he do? Pleaded. Save yourselves from this what? It's a dark world out there. The church came out of a dark and evil world. Look at your life before you were a Christian and tell me that isn't the case of the world you lived in. Tell me if that doesn't describe your life. And if you have a hard time doing that, either you were brought up in a wonderful, almost for sure, non-existent family, or you don't understand what salvation means. Salvation means you're saved from something into something else. There should be such a clear understanding in your mind of good and evil, of dark and light, of what you, who you were, what you did, how you lived your life, how you thought, how you used your possession, how you treated others, you should be able to say, that's who I was. By the grace of God, I am no longer. Doesn't mean you're perfect. It just means you're not living in the sewer anymore. And the sewer is not to be understood by how we judge what's good or bad. It's what God says is good and bad. Is this true of your life? Where you have truly been saved, truly been delivered. Your life has transformed from what you used to be and how you thought into something different. If that's not the case, you're not saved. There's no life transformation over the years. You cannot in any biblical manner say you're saved. You could say you're religious, but you're not saved unless there's been a clear change. You have come what? Come out of. In Middle Earth was in the shadow, if you will, the grasp of evil. It's almost like you're living in the darkness, but all of a sudden there's a little glint of light and you begin to walk toward it. Folks, that's salvation. You lived as a sinner for some of us decades, and all of a sudden God's holiness, God's love came upon us and we pursued it and left what we had lived in. In Middle Earth, we see that. And much more than a bad boy wizard like Sauron, we have an enemy that is very real. He's called, we've gone over his name. His name is Satan. It is Lucifer. It is the devil. He hates God. He hates all that is good. And he hates, hear me this, godly people. He will do everything in his mind possible to destroy your life. And if you stand alone, the Bible says he's like a roaring lion that seeks to devour his prey. He will come after you. The people in the Bible who fell into sin, who were followers of God, who fell, were people who were alone. People living in isolation. People without accountability. People who thought they were too good, too tough to go down. And many examples in Scripture. So in our story here, we see that the enemy is real. We see that there's a force that has to work together, that has to come out of that and do something against the evil, fight the evil, resist the evil in order for them to be successful. In John 12, 31, Jesus called Satan the prince of this world. In 2 Corinthians 4, 4, Paul said, called Satan the God, little g, of this age. For lost people, he is their God. It says in Ephesians 2, 2, the ruler of the kingdom of the air, the spirit who is now at work in those who are disobedient. That's the way it describes this Satan character. We have to understand that if we're truly saved, we have departed from and we're walking towards the light. And if you've ever walked down a tunnel, you look behind you, it's pitch black. You look at the side, it's still pretty dark, isn't it? But ahead of you is a light. I'm not saying you don't have times where you trip, where you bump into the wall of darkness, but your desire is to keep going towards the light and not go back to who you were. The word church literally means, is the Greek word ekklesia. It means a group of people called out of something for something else. Doesn't mean you just go to church. Lost people inhabit many churches in our country. Ekklesia means God has called you from this into this, a better way of living. Holiness, not sin. With like-minded people who love Jesus, not those people who hate Jesus and mock Jesus. Ecclesia is exactly what the nine in Middle Earth were. A group of people called out of the darkness to fight the darkness. Number two in your notes, the church consists of many, but committed to be one. Now look at the church. I've said this for years. If there's one thing you ever remember about me when I'm dead and gone, is this saying. It's not smack, smack. Many of you remember that. You could remember that if you choose. The one saying I want you to remember is this. It'll help you get along with one another in your family, in your church, work, and school. Everybody is somebody else's weirdo. That means you are a weirdo to somebody else. I know that's hard for some of you to grasp because you think you're perfect. Every one of us have things that irk others, that lead others to misunderstand us, that create barriers. But that's only if we're looking here and not looking at Jesus. See, if we're looking at Jesus, he brings all the weirdos together to march towards his cause, which is to win the world for him. We're going to be weirdos till we get to heaven. Can you just look at somebody and say, hey, Bryce, you're a weirdo today. You can say it back to me. There you go. Say it to somebody today. You might as well get used to it because we are. Quit acting like we're perfect. Quit acting like everybody should love everybody. Oh, love, 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 love. Yeah. When we focus on Jesus, it is possible to love other people. You're not always going to like the people you're with. So keep this thought in mind as we look at this. The church consists of many of us, but the church should be committed to be one. We rally together because Jesus indwells us. We rally together because Jesus is our reason for living. We rally together because he has given us a mission. And when we think that way, it's amazing what we can accomplish. Our weirdness becomes less. It never goes away, folks. Just keep that thought in mind. It never goes away. It's a group of people, and you, I don't know if you can see that. It looks almost like ants. That cross is made up of people. Jesus is what brings us together. Jesus is the one who brings us together. Look at verse 41. People came to faith. If we're a biblical church, people are coming to faith. People are getting saved. It says here in verse 41, if you read it quickly, 3,000 people come to faith in one day. That would be the bomb. Now, I will be a believer in the Detroit Lions when they win a Super Bowl. Oh, they got close. Oh, they got close again. They've been close for 50 years, folks. They ain't done it yet. So I'm never going to be a Lions fan until they win, okay? That, to me, would be almost as big as seeing 3,000 people coming to faith all at one time. Okay? That's how big a miracle it will take. So verse 41, people came to faith. Here's another thing about our church, or should be. People chose to mature. Look at verse 42. They devoted themselves to the apostles' teaching and to fellowship and to the breaking of bread and to prayer. Notice their spouses hounded them. The pastor knocked on everybody's door and said, won't you read the Bible with the rest of us? No, it says they, the weirdos, devoted themselves to grow. All we can do as a congregation, folks, is offer you things that will help you grow. You have to make the choice. It's that simple. Your spouse can't live your faith for you. Parents, you can't live your faith for your kids. Everybody must choose to mature. Third thing, look at verse 43. People caught the nature of the church. When you read through verse 43, they see it as a place where spiritual stuff matters, where spiritual stuff takes the precedent, where spiritual stuff is expected. They caught the nature of the church. This is not a social club, folks. This is not. You may see your family here. You may see longtime friends here. That shouldn't be the reason that you come to church. The reason you come to church is because the God Spirit indwells all of us and wants to use me to bless you and for you to bless somebody else. If we have this mentality, I come to church because I want to get something. And people better talk to me. I'm going to sit right on my little chair here. I'm going to walk in and I'm going to sit in this chair. Who's going to come talk to me? And then when church is over, I'm out. On you. That is not church. Church is when you walk up to a chair and you say, "Hi, my name's Fred, and I'm weird. Are you?" You know, you go out of your comfort zone and you bless others and you impart to others. That's the church. That's being a spiritual body, not a social club. Look at verse 44, 45. How do I know if you're acting like you're part of the church? Because you change your priorities. Your priorities become about Jesus. Your priorities become about other people. All the believers were together and had everything what? They sold property and possessions to give to anyone who had need. They began to care about one another, both in the church and outside of the church. And when we watch the movie, the movies, you see that this nine, they give of themselves, they sacrifice, they serve others, not just themselves. They go out of their way to, we could honestly say, to be the church to people in Middle Earth. That's how we know that we're a biblical church. When our priorities change, it's no longer about, it's about other people. Number three, the church continually developed their relationships. Verse 46, every day they continued to meet together in the temple courts. They broke bread in their homes and ate together with relationships take time. And if all you do is come to church, hear me, 1.2 times a month is the norm in this country now. That's how often people attend with other believers. 1.2 times a month. How are you ever going to develop a relationship with people? You can't. It's superficial at the very best. You have to commit to put forth energy and time into others. And that's why we have home groups, we have classes, we have one-on-one mentoring, we have various ministries in the church. Like yesterday, we had a church work day. You could come spend several hours with people. It's a sacrifice. But that's how you get to know people, is you invest time and energy. If you're unwilling to do that, then where's your part in the church? Where's your part in the church? Attendance. Who do you get to know sitting here at a table? People at the table for a few minutes, but you don't develop lifetime friendships with them. You don't develop any sense of intimacy or depth with them. There's a number of you here that I have asked personally to connect with, to have pumpkin pie and ice cream and whipped cream and the necessities of life, coffee. You know, that's how we get together, and that's a sacrifice for me. It's a sacrifice for you to find an hour during the week to meet with somebody. Your goal over the rest of this year should be to find somebody every week that you're going to pray for. I don't know who you are. You look weird, but what's your name? Tim? I'm going to pray for him. Some of you could say, "Hey, Tim, let's get together for a coffee." Some of you could say, "Hey, do you like to walk? Let's go out on the church's 78 acres and walk." You spend time with people, and we become the church. That's how we band together. You cannot band together by having superficial, consumer-driven relationships. Number four, the church changed the world with a missional mindset. Verse 47, praising God, enjoying the favor of all the people, and get this, the Lord added to their number daily those who were being saved. The nine in the stories impacted their world. You cannot impact planet Earth, I don't think. I can't, but you could impact your world. You realize there's a difference between planet Earth as the world, the 8 billion people as the world, and your group of 10 or 12 that you see on a daily basis? That's who you're to impact. When we have a missional mindset, that I'm put here, I've been saved to reach others, to represent Jesus, to be kind, to love people, to treat them decently. That's how you begin to impact human lives, one at a time. So this is what we see the nine doing. It's a perfect description of the church. So to wrap this up, here's the deal. Are you part of the church or not? I'm not talking about membership. I'm talking about, have you come to faith with who? Jesus Christ. And have you committed your life to a local group of people who think the same way, who have prioritized Jesus in their life? Are you part of the church? Notice I didn't say, do you attend church? Are you really part of a church? Whether this church, if you're visiting, of some other church, where you are bonded to them, your lives are entwined with them, you're growing to know them, you sacrifice for them, you serve them, you surrender selfishness for camaraderie. Is that true of your life? Because that's what the church is. Church is not an organization that you attend when you feel like it. It's a group of people that you're bonded with by Jesus, who indwells us with His Spirit. So on your table, in your little popcorn thingy, some of you already have this out, you'll find a ring. Pull that ring out. Everybody at your table should have a ring. Now, I'm going to give you just one example of what it means, of what being bonded together as the church looks like. Okay, you got your ring? Just open it up. Some of you don't even have a ring. In the sense, it's not this, it's having a spiritual connection to somebody, because that's what that illustrates. See, I'm bonded to a group of people here in the church. Every Friday morning for 4 years plus, we have met together for coffee, wonderful little snacky sandwiches, over in Charlotte at the coffee shop, 7 o'clock in the morning for 4 years straight. That's beyond attending church, folks. So if you're in that group, I want you to bring your ring and come up here. Sit on the steps, Tim. You see, here's what I've done. I've committed my life to grow with these individuals, to be accountable to these individuals. And we've had others that aren't part of the group anymore because of change of schedule, change of church, whatever it may be. But I'm connected to Mr. Ed. Okay? Mr. Ed and I are connected with Nick. Doesn't, maybe.